Hallelujah.
Praise the Lord. Glory, glory, glory. All right. I'm on the list of what we learned from the miracle of Jesus turning the water into wine. We learned, number one, that Jesus is God over nature. Number two, that He desired to bless. Number three, that He fulfilled the promise of God in Isaiah 55:1. Number four, we saw it as a typical of John 1 and verse 17. And that was the last point. Number five, we see that Jesus just exercised His will. He just exercised His will and the miracle was done. And it didn't take any incantations, no magic words. Just the exercise of His will. He didn't have to use any stardust. Anything. He just exercised His will. He willed it to be, and it was. He desired it. You know, it's interesting. So often, in faith, when a person will believe that it's an exercise of the will. That's all it is. It's just, in your heart, you just determine that this is the way it is because God promised. And that's the way it's going to be. Because God can't lie. It's just an exercise of the will. You don't have to, beat on the wall for an hour and a half. And often when Jesus did speak, He did it for others and not for Himself. In John 11:42, when He prayed, He says, Father, and He says, I pray not for me, because you hear me always, but I pray for them, that they might know that it was you that was doing the miracle. And so it was for others. He just lived His life before God, choosing to do the will of God, and it was done, and it would be done. Sixthly, we see Christ's perfect faith. He had absolute faith in His Father and in the plan of God. Jesus did not tell the servants, now bring that water to me first. I want to check it. I don't want any mistakes here. He just said, take it to the governor of the feast. He didn't say, bring it to me and let me check it first. Take it to the governor of the feast. That's all that was required. Total faith. Number seven, the water was not to be left in the jars. It was to be poured out. Water that's left in the jars gets stale, unusable. In fact, it even starts to breed, icky, crawly things. You know what I mean? It needs to be poured out. The same way with you and I. You get all that water inside, you don't pour it out, you get icky and stale too. That's right. Crawly things start growing inside of you. You need to pour it out. And then it becomes a blessing. You need to enrich other people's lives with what God gives you. You need to use it. Talk about it. Think about it. Tell others. Share. Pour out of your life. Seriously, honestly, I've seen this all too often. The only lack in that person's life was they weren't ministering. That was their only lack. They had a good prayer life. They were getting the Word of God. They were willing. They were open. But because they were not ministering, they were drying up. They were dying. They were witnessing. They didn't witness. You've got to witness. You know it's unhealthy not to witness? Did you know that? It's unhealthy not to witness. Part of your health is sharing with others the good things God does in you. You got to give out. You got to pour out. And really, even for self-preservation, you may need to do it. Just start, go minister to somebody. Just say, okay, for the next week, I'm not going to think about myself. I'm doing just fine. God's taking care of me good. I'm just going to pray for others. I'm going to minister for others. I'm going to reach out. I'm going to find somebody to witness to. I'm going to just go tell somebody. Just go tell them. You know, I've even felt that stagnation at times. And I'll just be out and about and I'll just go up to somebody and say, Jesus loves you. You know what I mean? Just to break out. Just to get out of it, you know. If you do something, you know. And just to kind of get going on it. And the best thing to do is just start loving people. Just start loving people. Honestly concerned about their life. the way I gave you is kind of legalistic and it can backfire on you sometimes. But if you love people, just give your heart to people. Just be honestly concerned. Just sit there and maybe you're at the, you know, wherever you're at a store or something. Just look at something. Just consider. That's a soul. They're going to spend eternity somewhere. They need to know about Jesus. I wonder what their life is like. I wonder if they know the Lord. I wonder what they did this morning. I wonder what their upbringing was like. I wonder what their parents were like. I wonder what they have to put up with. You know? What spirits, evil spirits are in their life? You know? Just start to consider and weigh and begin to be concerned and compassion on them. Involve yourself with people. It's unhealthy to keep that water in those stone pots. And it becomes wine when you pour it out. Number 8. We see that this miracle was a confirmed miracle. That's the way the miracles of God are. They are confirmable. And how it was confirmed is, the servants, they didn't taste the wine themselves, but they knew where it came from. And the governor, he did not know where it came from, but he tasted it. And so neither one collaborated. It was just a miracle, confirmed. That's the way you see God working. Number 9. We see a principle here in this miracle, and that is that in God's work, the last is always best. But you know what? In Satan's work, it's just the opposite. The last is always the worst. Hell, I mean, you can't get much worse than that. But it's true, the devil gives you the quick fix, you know? But for what? What's it going to lead you to? You know? Destruction. Whereas in God, it might take a little while, but what you get is lasting and brings forth tremendous fruit, tremendous blessing. Next point, number 10. Jesus was humble in his miracle. You know, you got to be humble if you're going to be used of God. You got to be humble if you're going to continue to be used of God. He didn't have a fanfare and have everybody all come around and say, "Now hear ye this, hear ye this. Come and watch today. We will have a, you know. Now watch this, fellas. You never seen anything like this in your life." And that's not what he did. He just got the job done. There was a need. And even though Mary would have done that sort of thing, I mean, that's the flesh's tendency, is to desire after a fanfare and a demonstration of the flesh. And that's what she would have fallen to. Even though that was the case, Jesus did not do it. He just in humility just met the need. And the result was is that his disciples believed. In verse 11, it says, "And his disciples believed on him." Number 11. We see in this miracle a type of these stone jars representing man. Representing man. 6 is the number of man. Man stands there empty, inadequate. He needs to be filled up. So at the command of Jesus Christ, the servants fill it up. The servants are like the ministers. So they go get the water of life and they fill up the stone pot. So they fill up the saints with water. And in God's economy, they'll be filled to the brim. That's the way the Lord wants it. The Lord wants the people of God to be absolutely filled to the brim, chock full. And then the church is to be poured out for others. So the ministers, they take that water of life and they say, "All right, now let's go out to the world." They take it to the governor of the feast, you know, as it were. They take it out to others so that they can be blessed. I thought that thing was kind of high today. And so as man pours out his life to others, then that water of life becomes a blessing. And his existence is fulfilled. Now, what greater purifying could there be than that this water were turned to wine? And now, instead of water, to purify it in a legalistic manner, all their vessels, you know, as if there was a ceremonial cleanliness, Now that water is turned into wine. It's turned into life to be poured out into the inside of people. And that's exactly where the cleansing must take place. Before, and that's where man has been. The best he's been able to do is some outward, liturgical, legalistic, ritualistic cleansing. A formalism. But when Jesus Christ touches that life and they're poured out to the saints, then their life becomes a cleansing on the inside, as it were. A purifying and a strengthening and a life-giving on the inside. Number 12, we see in this that what is first in Christ is then meant to be in us. Because Jesus was full of water, and He poured Himself out and turned into blessing, and that's meant to be in us. And it's typified here by the water and the wine coming forth from these stone pots. Number 13, we see that these stone pots represent Christ. Number 6, again, is the number of man. Christ as a man was filled with purity, was filled with the Holy Spirit. He was filled with the water of life. He was filled with the essence of the Godhead to the brim. And then He poured it out to others. But what did He pour out? He poured out His blood. That's red too. He poured out His blood. And His blood became a blessing, a wine. And He poured out His life. And His life became a blessing. That is new life to others. It's interesting that Jesus said in John 6:53, it says, if you do not drink of my blood, you will have no life in you. And that red wine looked like red blood. So He poured out of His life and it became blessing to us. Point number 14. Jesus refused to succumb to a demonstration of the flesh. But He still manifested His Father's glory. He refused to succumb to a demonstration of the flesh, but He still manifested God's glory. Only it was to the right hearts, to the hearts that would receive. So it wasn't a carnal fanfare, but to those that would believe, there was a miracle that would impress them and help them and bless them. And His disciples did believe. Point number 15, another possible type, and that is that the water refers to tasteless human reasoning. And man is full of tasteless human reasoning to the brim. But when it's touched by Jesus Christ and it's given in ministry unto Christ, it becomes an abundance of blessing and truth. And God will use your mind. He'll use your understanding. But it will become an abundance of blessing and truth. And then point number 16. Mary had a need and requested Christ to fulfill it after a carnal motivation. Or maybe I should not say after a carnal motivation. But after a carnal method. Do you know what Jesus did? He honored the real need of her heart. And that's what He meant. Two things. He honored the real need of wine, because they needed wine. That was the real need. And He also honored the real need of her heart. Because she had a need inside of her heart, and that's when she yielded to that the carnal bent to have Him prove Himself. And to show Himself openly. But what was her need? Her need was to see her son that had been given the promise of God to begin to step into that ministry. She'd hid all these things away in her heart. She had a need to have her son fulfill what God had planned for him. And she saw that happen also. Because He turned the water into wine and she could see that this truly was that one that God said that He was. Now let's talk about the wine for just a moment. Back on chapter 2 and verse 10, What kind of wine was it? Mogan David. Everybody knows that. Mogan David. That's what my dad always uses, a Lutheran pastor in their communion services. So I'm sure that's what they had then, right? John 2 and verse 10. And he said unto him, every man at the beginning doth set forth good wine. And when men have well drunk, then that which is worse. But thou hast kept the good wine until now. Now, until men have well drunk, it doesn't mean until men are absolutely soused, plastered, and inebriated. The idea here is filled. Now, depending on the context, it can mean intoxicated. But here, it definitely does not. Jesus would never have condoned a drunken feast. And the point is that when men have drunk a lot, it dulls the taste. And that's true to anything. Milk, even. Milk has a taste. You drink a lot of it, you lose the taste. You know, over you know, a lot of it. Apple juice. Water, even. You know, water has a taste. The more you drink, the more you lose the taste of the water. And it's just that way. You know, it's that way to the body system. It's that way with food. You lose the taste after you've eaten a lot of it. So, when men have well drunk, then they put on that which is worse, because then their taste is not going to be as sharp. So you bring on the best first, and then that which is not as good later. Here it was just the opposite. The best is for last. Jesus never would have condoned a drunken feast. He wouldn't have. There are many prohibitions against it in the Old Testament. Proverbs 20. Let me just list off a few. I'm not going to take the time to read through them. Proverbs 20 and verse 1. Proverbs 23, verses 29 to 31. Hosea 4, verse 11. Habakkuk 2 and verse 15. Hosea 7 and verse 5. Isaiah 5 and verse 22. There are many woes against the children of Israel because of drunkenness. It's interesting, there is one time where it says, let a man drink of strong wine, in Proverbs 31, verses 4 through 6. Guess who? Somebody who's perishing. But the man who's perishing, he's already lost. He's given over. And let him take a strong drink. And it's a typological picture, of course, in a spiritual sense, is one that's been given over after he's already gone under the flesh. He's given over to it because that's where he's living. That's his choice. And in Ephesians 5 and verse 18, be not drunk with wine. It's a command. Be not drunk with wine. Wherein is excess? But be filled with the Holy Spirit. The best wine at the time of Christ was not intoxicating. At least like the wine that we have. I'll explain. Among the particular historians at that time, there are three and others that mentioned that the best wine was innocent wine. And innocent wine was the non-intoxicating wine. Pliny, Plutarch, and Horace are among the list of those that said and state that. In good circles, all intoxicating wine was diluted, 2 or 3 parts water to 1 part wine. And diluted wine, of course, would not be as savory as undiluted wine. But they wouldn't drink it in good circles, that is, in its intoxicating state. So to have a wine that you did not have to dilute would be the best wine. And here was a wine that did not have to be diluted. It could be used straight. The Passover was in the spring of the year, and that was, you know, several months after the gathering of the vintage. And so you're not going to have just fresh squeezed grape juice. And intoxicating wine was forbidden at the Passover. So they would take the normal fermented wine that was available and they would dilute it 2 or 3 parts water to 1 part wine. The non-intoxicating wine was the best because, number one, it was only available for a short time in its pure state. And it depended on the type of grape that was normally harvested. To my understanding, the grape that was harvested the most, which was evidently a hardier grape, did not have as high of a sugar content. And it would not begin to ferment for a couple, 3 months. And then the fermentation process would continue over about a six-month period. And so after 9 months, it would be at its highest state. But it's still not a fermentation that it's still not a wine as we consider wine, like we're used to in America. I was talking to a brother that lived in the East, and he said that that type of wine that was, you know, taken from the field and pressed out and then just kept and stored, it was a slow fermenting process. And when it was in its fermented state, even at that point, it would take about a gallon before you'd ever get drunk. So you had to drink an awful lot of it. Now, a person that would be given to wine would be one that would do that. And that was forbidden in the New Testament. But to drink a cup or to drink a quart of it would not intoxicate you. And even though it had entered into a fermentation. And this could be kept for some time. Plus, it was the best because you could drink all you wanted. You wouldn't get intoxicated. You could drink all you wanted. You wouldn't lose out because your mind would be taken away. Plus, it was the best because you could drink it without diluting it. So it would be the tastiest. You drink the most of it. It was available for the shortest time. It was the innocent wine. And in that day, it was the best wine. Now, wine was a term that was used for any fruit of the vine when it was pressed out, any juice of the grape, whether it was fermented or not fermented. It was called wine, no matter what state it was in. In America, our wine is a whole lot different than their wine. In general, our wine has got alcohol put into it. It's compounded with several things. The cheaper wine even has strychnine in it to give it a little kick. It's drugged up, it's brandied, it's mixed, it's got all kinds of stuff in it. Our wine is not like just the pure fruit of the vine that you find in the East. Now, I'm talking among the common folk. Obviously, among the kings and those that are in higher position, they'd probably go through the same processes and mix it and so forth. It talks about mixed wine in the Old Testament, and there's prohibitions given against it because it was normally a heavily intoxicating wine. And it does depend on the type of grape used. There are some grapes that they ferment, the juice ferments right in the grape. And I talked to somebody that was from Greece, and they ate 3 grapes and got drunk. They're a spirit-filled Christian. They're living over there, and I mean, wine is a part of the staple of your diet. Wine is like milk is to us. They drink it regularly with their meals. It's a part of their diet. And it's a good food. It's got a high sugar content. It's got a lot of carbohydrate in it. And it's really a good food. And they drink it all the time, and they drink it a lot, and they're used to it. Even when it starts to get fermented some, it's still not intoxicating. And you can still drink quite a bit of it, and it'll last for a while. But as a food, in some ways, among the common folk, they still have the same type of feeling. At the best is the non-intoxicating, that which is not entered into a heavy fermentation process. But there's some that either because of the heavy sugar content or whatever, they start fermenting right in the grape. And you can get drunk. In fact, some is so powerful that you can actually get drunk smelling it. And he said you have to be careful. If you drink it, you cannot smell it. There's some that is so powerful that if you just sniff it, your mind goes away. There's some of that. In fact, among the rabbis, they write that the new wine, of certain kinds of these, the new wine, it says it quickly takes away the mind. And there's some of it that as they press it out, it immediately begins to ferment, and it ferments so violently that it actually boils. It looks like it's boiling. It's just moving and bubbling. It's fermenting so rapidly. And so there's different kinds. So the best was the non-intoxicating, the non-fermented kind. In the Old Testament, it was the opposite. The best was the fermented and had to be carefully treated. But from the time of the intertestament period on into the time of Christ, the best wine was fresh wine, non-fermented. And so you could basically say that what Jesus made, turned the wine, the water into, was grape juice. You could basically say grape juice. That's what we would call it. Now, they used the term wine for anything pressed out of the vine from when it was first pressed until, you know, whenever. And there are also different types of wine. There's one that they called must. And there was one they called dibs. Dibs was where they boiled it. They actually boiled it down to a real heavy concentrate. And they'd preserve the concentrate. And that would be non-intoxicating, too. They preserve the concentrate, they'd boil it up, preserve it, and then mix it with water later. Then there was one called dibs. No, I've got it mixed around. That was the dibs. The must was the kind that they would actually seal it in jars and place it in the earth where it was cooler. And that would maintain a non-fermented state for a long period of time. They'd seal it up, put it in the earth, they'd keep it cooler, and it'd stay non-fermented for quite a long time. That was called must, I believe. There's various different opinions about the wine as to how it was used and so forth, but we do know this. We do know that Jesus would not be a part of a drunken feast. We do know that he would not create intoxicating liquor, especially 200 gallons of it, to absolutely blow away this group of people. You know, he's not going to do that. And it's interesting that in Indonesia, where they had water turned to wine several times, that in each case it was not intoxicating. It smelled like wine. It didn't smell just like grape juice. It smelled more like a wine type of smell, but it was not intoxicating. It was not alcohol. It was not alcohol. And realize that the way the wine, because it's a food and it doesn't have alcohol in it, it's not mixed or anything else, the way it, even the fermented type, the way it intoxicates is somewhat different. It has a different impact, but it can do it. You know, there are a lot of things that grow naturally. In fact, somebody told me last night that here, I think it was a couple years ago, there was a group of Oregon grape. They brought forth their grape. You know, they grow wild, and it's a wild berry, and I don't think it's good for human consumption as far as I know. But there was, because of the lack of water and the tremendous heat or something, they fermented right in the berry. And the robins were eating them, and they were drunk. The robins were flying and into cars and staggering. They couldn't stand still. Staggering robins. This was down here in the Kent Valley that this was taking place. I think it was like a year ago or a couple years ago, something like that. And of course, in the New Testament, the misuse of it is prohibited. It says, "Be not given much to wine." And that's mentioned in 1 Timothy 3:8, Titus chapter 2 and verse 3. It also talks about how drunkards will not inherit the kingdom of heaven, 1 Corinthians 6 and verse 10. Drunkards will not inherit the kingdom of heaven. So the misuse is absolutely prohibited. But and Timothy, evidently, he was staying away from wine because of the connection with the fermentation, evidently. We don't know that for positive, but Paul writes to Timothy in 1 Timothy 5:23, and he says, "Take a little wine for your stomach's sake and you're off in infirmities." Evidently, he wasn't. He was evidently drinking the water. You know, there's some places where it's not good to drink the water. You know, Mexico is one of them. And there's some places where it's not good. And unless you build up natural immunity because you grow up in the area, whatever. But Timothy, from what we can gather, evidently was abstaining entirely, possibly because of the misuse of it in certain places. But Paul was basically saying, even though others misuse it, don't you misuse it, but do take some for your stomach's sake. Because the pure fruit of the vine, that's going to be all right. That's not going to be brackish like the water that's held in a cistern for months. You know, it's a pure fruit of the vine. It's going to be a blessing for you. It's going to be good for your stomach. Go ahead and do that. I'm sure that Timothy had not made a vow before God he never touched stuff. Because if he'd have done that, Paul would have been telling him to take it. But I have a feeling he was probably abstaining lest he'd stumble some others. And I don't mean stumble the way Paul uses the term stumble, but unless it might make others judge him and maybe be a problem in some way. Paul was, in that case, I would assume, would feel freer to say, go ahead and drink it. And even though others might, you know, have difficulty with it, that's their problem. That's not your problem. You're not misusing it. Don't be given to much wine, but do take some. You need it now. It'll help you for your stomach's sake and your often infirmities. So Jesus, if I were to give a bottom line statement, I would say that he turned water into grape juice. One other interesting point about the grape juice in the East, it's not real thin and watery like ours. It's more pulpy. In fact, it's almost syrupy, some of it. Depends on what grape you use again. But it's generally a thicker, it's got a little more pulp in it, it's more pulpy, and sometimes even thick, syrupy, that has to be diluted if you're going to drink it. I mean, it's almost like a, you know, it's a real thick pudding almost type thing. All right. So he turned the water into wine. Now, verse 11 says, "This beginning of miracles did Jesus in Cana of Galilee and manifested forth his glory, and his disciples believed on him." This is a beginning of miracles. And I'd like to point out three things in this miracle that represents all of his ministry and all of his miracles. Three things. Number one is that men sought after him. And that's what you find happening throughout his ministry. Men sought after him. Men are like sheep. They've gone astray. They're returning unto the shepherd and the bishop of their souls. And here we see that Mary sought after Christ. Well, throughout Christ's ministry, men sought after him, cried out to him. Even as if they do today, they'll meet him and he'll be found of them. Secondly, his word was with power and authority. And that's a very important thing in all of his miracles, that his word was with power and authority. He spoke it and it was so. And that's, of course, our life. The word of God is our life. And thirdly, he demanded faith and obedience. You see that happening throughout the ministry of Jesus. He demanded faith and obedience. It's interesting. Remember when Israel came through the Red Sea? How hard was it for them to get the Red Sea open? When they were just screaming their fool heads off, crying out to God, Moses said, "Stand still and you'll see the salvation of the Lord." And they just looked around and there it was, and they took off. They didn't do much of anything. But when they got to the Jordan, it was different. Notice Joshua didn't raise the rod. Notice Joshua didn't command it to just happen and it happened. Joshua didn't run through the water and make it go back. Remember what happened at the Jordan? God commanded the priests to take up the ark on their shoulders and to march through the Jordan. And you know what? That Jordan never rolled back until they touched it with the sole of their feet. Just picture yourself walking down to the Puget Sound. Okay, I'm heading for Vashon, you know. They walk right up to the water, and it's not until the sole of their foot touched the water that it rolled back. And then the sole of their foot touched it again, and it rolled back from there. It just rolled back as they touched it. That took faith. That took faith. I've seen God do healings like that. Sometimes you're a new convert, you're praying, boom, just the whole thing. Now you got to stand against the devil. And you pray and part of it goes. And you got to pray the next point. More goes, you know. You got to stand in the gap. You got to believe. You got to express your faith in obedience. And I see Jesus doing that in his ministry, because he was not only healing the people, he was teaching them. He was training them. He was growing them up. So what did he do? He told Peter, he said, "Come." Peter had to leap out of the boat and come on the water. He told the man laying on the bed, there he is, laying on the bed, hasn't moved in 38 years, "Take up your bed and walk." "You take up your bed and walk." "Yeah, sure." If that's what he'd done, he'd have laid there and stayed there. He obeyed. He took faith and obedience. He told the 10 lepers, he said, "Go to the priest and show yourselves." You didn't go to the priest and show yourself when you were a leper. You went to the priest and showed yourself when you were cleansed. It was as they obeyed, it says, as they went, they were made whole. And as they were going, all of a sudden, one realized he was healed. And he went back to Jesus. Thank him for it. See, because they were healed as they went. They just told him, they just did what he told them to do. Here we are, lepers heading off to the priest. We're going to really get ridiculed and rebuked if we're not healed by the time we get there. I mean, see, that's the point. But he said, "Go." The man that was healed, "Go to the pool Siloam and wash." That was blind. See, he was healed of his blindness. He had the plaster on his eyes. So Jesus demanded faith and obedience. And that's the way it is for you and I. So number one, seek after Him with all of your heart. Number two, trust in His Word. It's got power. It's got authority. And number three, do what He says. And you will receive a miracle. You'll receive the ministry of Jesus Christ in your life if you do those things. Simple. And it works. Not it. God. But it is what He has established with us. Okay, next section, Jesus cleansing the temple. John chapter 2, verses 12 to 17. John 2, 12 to 17. After this, He went down to Capernaum, He and His mother and His brethren and His disciples, and they continued there not many days. So they went down to Capernaum. Interesting that His family went with Him, His mother and His brethren. They were following Him. They were wondering what was happening now to our brother Jesus, or my son Jesus. We're familiar with Capernaum. Capernaum was quite a large city. It was a commercial fishing center. A lot of fish in the Sea of Galilee. It was also a traffic center. There were major roads going through Capernaum, connecting the east with the west and with the coastal harbors and on down into Egypt. There, it was large enough to have a detachment of soldiers there, Roman soldiers. In fact, a centurion built a synagogue. And from all indication, the only thing left of Capernaum to this day is a couple of pillars of that synagogue. Some feel it's probably the one that he had built. For the longest time, they didn't know where Capernaum was. And they're pretty sure they know where it is now. Also, a tax customs station was there. And undoubtedly because of the tremendous amount of commerce going through the city. And Capernaum became the resident city of Christ during His ministry. So Jesus didn't continue with Nazareth as His hometown. He left Nazareth and He moved to Capernaum. And that's where He lived during His ministry. Now, of course, He was itinerant a lot of the time, but He stayed in Capernaum. In fact, in Matthew chapter 9 and verse 1, listen to what it says. And He entered into a ship and passed over and came into His own city. That, we find, by parallel passage, was Capernaum. And I think context shows it also. But notice what it calls it. It calls it His own city. So that became Christ's hometown, as it were. That became Christ's home, His residence. The place where He resided during His ministry. Now, they didn't stay there for very long at this point because the Passover was at hand. And every male was required to attend it. In fact, there were three feasts every year that they were required to attend according to Exodus chapter 23, verses 14 through 16. Generally, among the Israelites, they didn't all make it to all three, but Passover probably being the largest one in attendance. Verse 13, and the Jews' Passover was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Notice, it says up to Jerusalem. Because the city of Jerusalem was on one of the highest tablelands in the area. If you looked at the maps of topography, you'll notice that the mountains right south of Jerusalem are some of the highest mountains around there. That tableland actually gets up to 3,700 foot. It's not mountain peaks, it's a tableland. It gets up to 3,700 foot. That's pretty high. Oh, excuse me, that's 3,700 feet above the Dead Sea. 3,700 foot above the Dead Sea, and the Dead Sea is 1,300 minus. The northwest part, the highest part of the city of Jerusalem, is 2,581 feet above the Mediterranean sea level. That's pretty high. 2,500 feet, or almost 2,600 feet. The Snoqualmie Pass, it's just a little bit above 3,000. That seems really high, doesn't it? Jerusalem is only 500 feet below that. And from here to Snoqualmie Pass is like, what, 60 miles? But to Jerusalem, from the Mediterranean Sea, is only like about 30 or 40. And it was a city, so it's pretty high. You know, it's quite a increase. And you've got the lowlands along the coast that are real fertile, the plain of Sharon is there, and different ones are real fertile. And then you come in the hill country, and there's a lot of growing of the vines and different things. Then it gets up in the more mountainous, and it's a desert-like area, and that's where Jerusalem is. That's a lot what the area is like there. Certain parts of it, on the certain hillsides, grapes grow real well in that part of the country, though. It's green in the spring, but it gets real deserty and desolate-looking major part of the year. So that's why it says he went up to Jerusalem. Because no matter where you came from, you went up. North, south, east, or west, you came up to Jerusalem. Now the Passover commemorated their exit from Egypt. And the story is in Exodus 12, 7 through 11, where they're told about the commemorating of it and the death angel passing over all those who had the blood of the Lamb on their homes. And so that Passover was a passing over of the death angel. And so they commemorated it every year. And what they did at the Passover is they ate a meal, the beginning of it. It's a seven-day feast, actually. Seven-day feast. There are different aspects of it. And one of the main aspects is on the first night of the feast, they would eat a lamb, or it could be a goat, a young goat or a young lamb, with unleavened bread, without leaven, and bitter herbs, and they'd eat it in haste. And they often would have themselves girded up with their staff in hand, and they eat it in haste, commemorating when they got out of Egypt, because that's what happened that night. They sacrificed that lamb, they ate it, the death angel passed over, a whale went up in Egypt, and they got out of there right then. They got out of there right then. The lamb or the goat was to be 1 year old in the prime of life. And that's typical of Jesus Christ, who died in the prime of life. It's also to be roasted with fire, which represents the judgment that was on Jesus Christ. Because he was not boiled in water. That would speak of mercy in judgment. He had no mercy in his judgment. He was totally forsaken of his Father and given over to death. So he was roasted with fire. It's interesting that they also killed the lambs in the evening, anywhere between 3 and 6 p.m., towards the evening time. And so also Jesus Christ, he died at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. The lamb was also to be taken from the flock. This is a specific thing. Take it from the flock. Even as Jesus Christ is our brother. He's bone of bone and flesh of flesh. Also, the lamb was to have no bones broken. So also Christ, no bones broken. He had no bones broken. The bones represent the inner man. He was not broken as to his inner man, but he was strong in spirit, trusting in God all the way through his life. Also, the bread they were to eat was to be unleavened bread throughout the feast. In fact, this is one of the main factors of the feast. And it is so prominent that the feast is actually called the Feast of Unleavened Bread in Exodus 12 and verse 18. Because they ate leavened bread all year round. To eat unleavened bread was unusual. Unleavened bread then was to be eaten. And the reason why is because leaven was a type of sin. It's a type of sin. It gets into a lump, even though it's a little bit of leaven, gets into a lump, pretty soon it spreads over the whole thing. Just like sin. It spreads. And it's that particular typology is referred to in 1 Corinthians 5, verses 6 through 8. Paul there is talking about putting somebody outside of the church, putting them out of the church. He said, a little leaven leavens a whole lump. Put them out, lest they affect others into the same kind of sin. It's interesting that the Jews would scrape their walls, they would scrape their floors, they would get all the leaven out because, I mean, you had bread around all the time, and that was their staple of their diet was bread, and so they'd have leavened bread, so there'd be leaven in the homes. So they'd scrape everything down and clean it on the day that they offered the lamb sacrifice so that there was no leaven in their homes. That was part of the commandment of God. Interesting that Orthodox Jews, they will actually scrape wallpaper paste, you know, the wallpaper and the wallpaper paste off their walls because some wallpaper paste has yeast in it. And they'll actually do that to get the leaven out of their homes. And I would assume that this is Jews that did not put that in purposely and then scrape it off once a year, but rather they bought a home that had it, I would assume, I would hope. I'd imagine that they'd get yeastless wallpaper paste, you know, otherwise. They would eat bitter herbs with it, representing the suffering that Christ went through. And, of course, the suffering that went through in Egypt. And that's the suffering in the world. And they would also drink wine mingled with water. Interesting, pointing to the blood and the water that came out of Christ's side. They would take forth the life of Christ that was offered for them. The blood and the water. The wine and the water. They'd also eat a sauce of figs and raisins and vinegar, pointing to it wasn't a sweet thing so much, but it was a sauce representing the fruit of the life of Christ given for them. Yes. They'd eat a sauce of figs and raisins and vinegar and other things. There were other things that they involved in it. Now, this is the Passover that Jesus is going to attend. As far as we know, he attended every Passover during his life and his ministry. That is, each one that occurred during his ministry. Three of them are noted specifically. One of them, we're not sure of, it may have reference to it in John chapter 5. Not exactly positive. So, verse 14. And he found in the temple those that sold oxen and sheep and doves and the changers of money sitting. That's what he found. He didn't want to find that, but that's what he found. We find out that Jesus purged the temple at the start and the finish of his ministry. First and last. And that represents that was his entire life, was purging the temple, purging his Father's house. He spent his entire ministry purging his Father's house. You know how Jesus is called the Alpha and the Omega? First and the last. That doesn't mean he's only A and Z. He's only two letters of the 24-letter alphabet. I think the Greek is 24. I can't remember, is it? And it doesn't mean that. But it means he's the A and the Z and everything in between. And so also, as he cleansed the temple at the beginning of his ministry and the end of his ministry, he's cleansing it all in between. Now, there were changers of money. What in the world were they doing in the temple? Jews were coming from all over the world. And they came from their own nation with its own currency. The Persians, the Tyrians, the Syrians, the Egyptians, the Romans, the Grecians. And they all had their own coins. But in the temple, they only accepted the Jewish shekel. And the Jewish coins, those are the only ones that were accepted for sacrifice. You know, I mean, to make it a little bit more sanctimonious. That really made no difference to God. But it made a big difference to them. Besides that, it was a good way to make money. And normally, the money changers got 25% on the exchange. Now, if you ever had to exchange your money over and lose 25% on it, you'd take the guy by the throat. But they didn't. They were stuck. They had no choice. Some of you actually were, huh? Well, that's but then you get it back when you give back, you know what I mean? Kind of, somewhat. A little bit of loss. You spend it all down here, huh? You don't have anything to change back. Well, anyway, that's different. What they were doing is they were getting exact, you know, across. And then they charged 25% and took that for their payment, see? So that's what I mean. I'm not talking about the exchange rate of, you know, currencies that are in different level. I'm not talking about that. It was all the same. It was all the same. And remember, their currency was the actual metal itself. It was the actual gold or the actual brass or the actual silver. And so it was by weight. Its price was according to its weight. So it had that was the same. So you get weight for weight, but in a different minting. And only they took 25% on it. So they made a lot of money there. They made a lot of money. These money exchangers. And it was all for, you know, religious purposes. Of course, to honor God, you understand. To give reverence and honor to Yahweh. And so we take 25%. And to those that were poor and had spent a lot on their journeys, this would be a tremendous hardship. Plus, what were they selling all these animals for? The sacrifice at the Passover was a lamb. It's because people came to take care of their other spiritual business. I mean, there were other sacrifices involving oxen and goats and so forth, and a heifer and so forth. And they would come and take care of all of that, get themselves purified, cleansed, go through all of those sacrifices that they needed to from everything they'd done wrong that year or whatever. You know what I mean? Not done wrong, but they, you know, whatever they had to purify themselves from, they would come early to the Passover, take care of that, buy those sacrifices, take care of all of that, and then be ready for the Passover. That's what they do. So that's what those were there for. Now, why were they in the temple? Because these were the official sacrifice animals. I mean, these babies were ready to go. They were already inspected. They'd been carefully cared for in the temple flocks. The temple had its own flocks. Or they had been bought and inspected. The temple officials had watched over them. These animals were certified. I mean, they were kosher. They were ready to go. And they cost a lot of money, too. They cost a lot of money. Now, you could get animals outside, and they were a lot cheaper. But they may not pass inspection. And you can be sure that the priests were a little bit slow to pass inspection for these outside the temple flocks, especially when they got a cut off the animals that were sold inside. And so it was a racket. I mean, it was a racket. It was a house of merchandising. They had turned the sacrificial system into a way of getting rich. And the Sadducees were rich. They were rich. They were the wealthy, among the wealthy class, and a large part of it was the sacrificial system. That's how they got so rich. And so the common people, the poor people, they were in a hard-pressed state. And it was hard to get by it. And they would lose even more money if they bought an animal outside, brought it in, and it was not accepted, see? It's interesting, the people saw this and they hated it. They called, the common people called, the Passover time, they called it the bazaars of the sons of Annas. So instead of the holy reverence of God in sacrifice, it was the bazaars of the sons of Annas. And you see, Annas was the chief political figure in Jewish history at that time, for quite a long period of time. And he had five sons and sons-in-laws that held the high priest position, besides himself. And he also had a very strong sway with the Roman government at that time because of the amount of money he had. He was absolutely rich. Remember, the Sadducees were the priestly caste. Those in the priesthood are those that made up the Sadducees. Not all priests were Sadducees, but the Sadducees were of the priestly class. And so you've got the temple area, you've got these money changers, you've got a lot of money laying around, you've got temple officials, you've got temple guards, you've got Roman soldiers. The place was like a police station. And that's where Jesus went and cleansed it. And how in the world did he get away with it? You wonder. The temple was no longer a place of worship and prayer. At the time of the Passover, it had become like a, first on one hand, a fortress, on another hand, a bank vault, and a marketplace, and a bazaar, to suck money from all the peoples, the millions that came from all parts of the world. No wonder they were rich. They also had much disputing, argumentation, political discussions, and religious discussions. It became a business center, and now it was even an animal, a place for animals, like a barnyard, full of the sound of animals and the smell of their odor and the dung and so forth. So what's Jesus going to do? Verse 15. When he had made a scourge of small cords, he drove them all out of the temple, and the sheep, and the oxen, and poured out the changers' money, and overthrew the tables. I mean, he didn't just have them take it. He threw it on the ground. You're going to take this out. You're going to take it out groveling. I mean, he hated what they were doing. I imagine that Jesus saw what it did to the heart of the common people. And he hated what it did to them, forcing them that way. The same way he hates when somebody under, quote, anointed preaching makes you feel like an absolute rat unless you give him your last dollar. And just sucks money from the poor. Makes you feel like you're the lowest thing on the face of the earth unless you give your last dollar to him. And he's the greatest one in all the earth. I know that that grieves the heart of God. It's turned the house of God into a place of merchandising. It's turned the sacrifice of God into a way to get rich, to get wealthy. And when you have a ministry that the majority of their preaching deals with getting rich and having money and doing it by giving money, that's an imbalance. It's a merchandising that has entered into the house of God. And I know God's not pleased with that. It's interesting that the very rushes that these animal owners used to drive the animals in was the very thing that Jesus used to drive them and their animals out. And it represents that their own deeds rose up against them. And that's what happens. One day, the deeds of those that have turned the house of God into merchandise will rise up against them themselves. Okay, I guess I have to let you go. Yeah. By the way, the temple area covered approximately 9 city blocks. It was a big area. And there undoubtedly were a lot of animals. Realize that at the Passover, 250,000 lambs were bought, sold, and sacrificed. So there were probably a lot of animals that were in that courtyard. I don't imagine all those animals were in the courtyard. I don't think they would have fit. But there would have been some of the temple ones that would have been. Thank you.